It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 5:30, we'll hear about a new computer bug that has security experts worried and what users can do to protect themselves.
The latest results from the Wisconsin survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute are out.
We'll be looking at the results for the rest of the week. Today, we look at what Wisconsin thinks about the upcoming governor's race between Scott Walker and Mary Burke.
We're joined now by Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College and Associate of the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. And in just a bit, we'll continue on with Tim Dale, a political scientist from UW-La Crosse. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's dig in. You asked people, if you were to vote today, who would you pick? And what was the response?
With all the respondents, 55% said that they would vote for Scott Walker, and 40% said that they would vote for Mary Burke.
So it was 55 Walker, 44 Burke.
Correct, yeah. And that's all of our respondents. These are not registered voters. It's just random selection of households, people over 18 in Wisconsin. When we asked about likely voters, we asked how likely they were to vote in November, and so among them, it's 56 for Walker and 40 for Mary Burke.
So then it leans even more in that direction. So this represents a bit of a departure from previous polls that we've seen, which indicated a tighter race. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think many of the other polls are probably using registered voter rolls, whereas ours is all respondents, so you don't necessarily need to be registered, because, of course, we still have same-day voting registration. So that may be one of the reasons. And then as part of that, this time around, we have more Republicans than Democrats in the sample. We have 37% of the sample were Republicans compared to 32% of Democrats and 25% of independents. But even among the independents, 53% of them said that they would vote for Walker.
What kind of commitment to their candidates did people express in the survey?
Well, of those who were Walker voters, they're very committed. They're not changing their mind anytime soon. Among Democrats, there's a little more room. They're not quite as committed to Mary Burke. I think a lot of them still don't know who she is. When we asked the favorability ratings, we saw that amongst the Democrats, that they're still not sure, haven't heard of her. And then particularly among the independents, they're very likely to change their vote. More than 40% of them said that they are likely to change their minds.
And how do these numbers compare to past governor's races in the Wisconsin survey?
It depends on how you're looking at it. If you look at it in terms of an incumbent who's running, and then there's, you know, the challenger, it's not that different. There tends to be, particularly this early on, there's an advantage for the incumbent because more people know who he, at this point, I can say still he, who he is, whereas the challengers always have more name recognition issues. And then another part of that advantage is amongst the people who are going to vote but are less perhaps politically engaged, they tend to sort of favor the incumbent as well.
And what is your takeaway as you look at these numbers? You know, we're still a ways out from the elections and the ground could shift, but what do you see right now?
Well, I think when you look at everything all together, so you look at the governor's approval rating, which is 59%, you look at his favorability ratings, which are 58%, along with then this average, I think that people, and also looking at the direction of the state, which is also very positive, that I think overall people are seeing that things are looking up. I mean, 57% of the people said that they think the state is going in the right direction, which compared to what we think about the country is almost opposite of that.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to move on and talk to our guest political scientist, but I appreciate you coming on and giving us the lowdown on what these results showed.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We talked to Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College and Associate of the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. And now we go to Tim Dale. Tim has been listening along, and he's a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Tim, what do you make of the latest results from the Wisconsin survey?
Well, it's similar to Wendy's reaction. I think that these numbers are very good for Scott Walker and also show that Mary Burke has some work to do when it comes to voters being able to identify with her, maybe even respond that they see her favorably. And definitely in order to earn their vote, she's going to have to do some work.
Now, as we talked about, you know, the point spread here is wider with Walker well in the lead, 55% saying they would vote for Scott Walker if the election were today, you know, when the survey was done, and 44% saying they would vote for Mary Burke. That's a spread. Was it surprising to you?
Well, I think one of the remarkable things about that, and I mean just in the sense of being able to remark about it, is that this is outside the poll's margin of error. So one of the things we look at with polls is what the margin of error is, and that's just the scientific predictability of the poll, which in this case is 5%. So even if we grant the margin of error, Walker is outside that, which means that if the election were to happen today, we can say pretty much with scientific certainty that he would win the race. So I think that's one significant thing that we can take away from this poll. I think the other thing is in terms of voter identification and which party voters are identifying with in these poll results. And the Republicans right now with this poll are the strongest that they've been since fall of 2010 with the same poll. So right now, as I think Wendy mentioned, 37% of voters who responded identified Republican. And that's as high as it's been since the fall of 2010 when it was 40%. I think that indicates that it's a strong year for Republicans, and I think the Walker campaign has got to be happy with these results.
Well, since first throwing her hat in the ring a few months ago, what sorts of efforts has Mary Burke been trying to get her name out there, get some brand recognition going, and getting people to flock to her banner?
Well, the stages of the campaign are such that Mary Burke has been interested right now in doing a lot of fundraising. She's also been traveling around the state trying to build the name recognition. We have seen some advertisements being purchased, but that really won't we won't see that as much as we will as the summer goes on. But there is some that initial stages of the campaign. As Wendy indicated, this is a very difficult race for an incumbent to lose or a challenger to win because you have the name recognition. And so already the cards are stacked against Mary Burke, and it is going to be a long road ahead.
And she's a bit of a newcomer to the political scene, or the state political scene anyway. Has the Democratic Party, do you think, fully embraced, or is that part of what we're seeing here, a fact that maybe they haven't quite gotten to know her yet?
Right. Well, when a new name enters the political fold, there are advantages and disadvantages to it. The Democrats, on the one hand, are happy that they can bring someone in from private industry to talk about some issues that they think they might be able to get some traction on. But as you say, this is a difficult situation. So one of the things that we see in the results of this poll is a remarkably high number of Republicans who support Scott Walker. Now, this may be obvious, but he has a 97% of Republicans say they will vote for Walker, which is very high. And Burke is also high, but not as high. She's at 88%, which means that nearly 10% of Democrats are now saying they will vote for Scott Walker. I think that indicates that her position among Democrats really needs to get stronger for her to do better. And I think it speaks to what you asked about, which is that her, even the recognition among Democrats and an uncertainty about what she will do is something that she's going to have to work on.
Now, we're about between, 6 and 7 months until the election. How deep in it are we right now, do you think? Or is it just beginning to simmer? I'm just curious about the rate of change you expect to see as we go into these months leading to the election day.
Right. Well, one of the ways to answer that question is to look at how committed voters are or how likely they are to stick with their decision. And I think there are a number of voters who aren't tuned in yet to the election. So when they answer a poll like this, they're answering kind of what occurs to them at the time. But voters tend not to spend a great deal of time analyzing candidates or thinking about their vote until the election comes closer. So the numbers become a lot more solid and predictable as we get closer to the election. I think that there are going to be many questions in the voters' minds in terms of why they will make the decision that they're going to make. I think that this is going to be an election that is going to be a referendum on Walker's first term in office. So he's had 4 years, and he's going to make the argument for why he should stay in office. And I think it is early, and we're not quite yet to the point where voters, particularly the ones who are the swing voters, are making up their mind. And so that definitely will be something that will be in flux until later into the fall.
We're talking right now about the latest results from the Wisconsin survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and St. Norbert College and what they say about the upcoming race between Scott Walker and Mary Burke. We've heard that among respondents, 55% saying they would vote for Walker had the election been held today, 44% saying they would vote for Mary Burke. Tim Dale is with us now to make sense of the finding. He's a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. And the door is open for you now. What do you make of the survey results and the wider point spread that we're seeing there as well? And how would you vote if election day were today? What do you make of that lead? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. The results of the latest Wisconsin survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute are out. And right now we are looking at the results and the numbers related to the state's upcoming governor's race. So far, it's good news for Scott Walker, bad news for challenger Mary Burke. 55% to 44% is the tally. We've got Tim Dale with us now. He's a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. And we're taking your calls now. What do you make of these survey results? And we're curious, how would you vote if the election were held today? What do you think might be the special challenges that are keeping Mary Burke's numbers lower? 44 is her number compared to Scott Walker's 55. What do you think she's up against? What do you think is might be holding her back? And why do you think Scott Walker seems to be faring so solidly among his supporters? Do you think Wisconsin has election fatigue? Does that factor into any of this as well? Call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go to our callers now. We've got Ben joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Glad to be talking with you. I just wanted to say I got to meet Mary Burke last week. She came to my college campus and spoke, and she seemed like a very nice lady and intelligent, all these sort of good things. Unfortunately, I think that she's going to kind of continue to suffer in the poll numbers and ultimately lose the election, though, because she doesn't really galvanize the left as much as she needs to, and kind of Obama did in 2008. He came out as such a radical candidate with really, bold proposals, and I don't think that she really has that. She kind of seems watered down. I was really excited about the possibility of Kathleen Vineout running from Western Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. She seemed to really be a strong candidate. Walker is so strong with Republicans because he has such a strong policy, bold policies. I think the left is sort of lacking that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that perspective, Ben. And Ben actually getting to meet candidate Burke at his college and saying she just didn't seem to bring anything that would galvanize the left and bring them to the table for her, get them to fight for her. And that Scott Walker does. He has bold policies. What do you think about that analysis, Tim?
Well, it certainly is a reaction that some Democrats are having. But I think when a party is selecting a candidate, there are a lot of factors that go into that. And the Democrats right now have the question whether or not they're more interested in galvanizing the base or they're more interested in attracting independent or moderate voters. And I think those kinds of strategic questions kind of come into play, and the caller indicates that the galvanized thing was something he was looking for. But in the case of Democrats in Wisconsin, Democrats are fairly motivated to not want Walker to be the governor. I think that the problem for them as they look at these numbers is they see Walker doing much better with independents than they would need in order to do well in the election. So there are definitely a lot of different strategic questions that go into the selection of a candidate.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Ben. And let's go next to Chuck. Chuck is joining us from Delafield. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I really have to steal some of the thunder of the guy who was on before me, or at least ride his coattails, because I also am gathering from interactions that I've had that that Mary Burke isn't quite not only motivating to the left. I've heard that she's made some comments about the minimum wage and how raising minimum wage at this juncture would be detrimental. But, for more an individual and a person, I'm just wondering if she has the charisma to really reach not only to your earlier points, that activist base with the Democratic Party, but just the independents and other people. you know, I'm not sure if she has much of that rock star quality in it. It's some of my thoughts at this point.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Chuck. And Chuck's saying maybe Mary Burke does not have the charisma factor, at least not for him. And also touching on a critique that, you know, maybe some people in the left feel that she's not left enough for them, not progressive enough. What do you think about those critiques?
Yeah, well, this links to something we were talking about a few minutes ago with the work that Mary Burke will have to do in order to win the election. The numbers are significant in these polls that show Walker ahead. Burke has work to do with Democrats to answer the challenges of the questions that the previous two callers have had. She has work to do with independent voters, where she's losing by nearly 20% among independent voters. So I think that that's definitely something that the Burke campaign is going to see in these results and know that they have to work on.
Now, these results are quite a bit different than polls we were seeing, I think, maybe a couple months ago, where it showed a much closer, sort of a neck-and-neck race. If you had to guess, what do you think happened between then and now, or is it just the polling mechanism?
Well, some of it can be explained by polls' margin of error. So when we see these poll results and we see a margin of error of 3 or 4 or 5%, that means plus or minus that number is the range that we are predicting. And those polls had the race closer, but Walker was still ahead in those polls. I think that as the as time goes on and as different ads are run for different campaigns, as people perceive things in the national media or the state media, as Walker also travels around the state, you're going to see these numbers fluctuate some. So some of that can be explained by just the polling mechanisms that are used and the number of people who answer the poll with different party affiliations. But part of it will just be a trend that we will be seeing either moving for a closer race or away from a closer race. And I think that part of it is that Republicans are feeling pretty confident and happy with Walker, and Democrats right now are still undecided or undetermined.
Now, would you say that the results that we're seeing with this survey indicate that it could be smooth sailing for Governor Walker, that that the ruffles on the water, the waves from the John Doe investigation maybe aren't really going to rock his boat, and he's just got to stay the course and he'll be elected, reelected?
I would say that, although no one from the Walker campaign will say that, certainly, because we have a long campaign, and so this will be work for Walker regardless of what these numbers show right now. Neither side will say that the race is over at this point. I think that we also haven't seen a lot of money having been spent on really either side, but particularly the Democratic side. We are definitely going to be seeing attack ads on both sides, and those may have some impact on the numbers. How they will impact the numbers, I think, remains to be seen. But I don't think it's a cakewalk quite yet.
All right, let's take another caller, and we may have time for one more call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Jim in Turtle Lake. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Hello, what do you think?
Hello?
Uh-huh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if Ron Kind or Russ Feingold wouldn't have had more name recognition in the state, throughout the state, and probably would have a little better chance at getting rid of Walker. I just wondered what comments you'd have on that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jim. And Jim getting at sort of the name recognition, a little bit of the star power that maybe Democrats were hoping for with someone like a Russ Feingold.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor, particularly this early in the race. Of course, one of the issues with having a candidate in the race is that they have to be willing to run. And in the case of those two other candidates, they were not willing to run. But it would certainly be true that these numbers might have been different if we would have had better name recognition in the race. Although something else that I'll mention is that this is a midterm election year, so we don't have a presidential race at the top of the ticket. And in midterm election years, it historically, and particularly recent history, Republicans have done much better than Democrats. And when Russ Feingold lost, we had a midterm election year. And so even with name recognition, there are other dynamics that go into these races that go beyond just a particular candidate or whether or not that candidate has been recognized. And I think by the time the election comes around, we will be talking much more about the issues, and people will be familiar enough with Burke to make an educated opinion about her.
And Tim, we've been talking about the race for governor between Scott Walker and Mary Burke, but I'm curious to get your take. Do you think that Republicans seem to have a lock on both houses in the legislature, or did Democrats have a chance here?
Right now, it looks like the Republicans are pretty well positioned. But as we mentioned for the governor's race, it's still pretty early. And in politics, 1 week can be a long time, let alone several months. But if the election were held today, it looks like the Republicans are in a pretty good position to take over the Senate. But the dynamics of each of those Senate races are completely separate. And so really to look at race by race, how the Republicans are doing and how the candidates are doing would be a longer conversation and one that's going to be very interesting to watch as the next few months go on.
All right, Tim, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Dale is a political scientist at UW La Crosse. He joined us to talk about the results about the race for governor in the latest Wisconsin survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a checkup on what's happening in Congress with USA Today's Paul Singer.
But first, many of us woke up this morning to reports of the Heartbleed bug, a glitch in the online encryption software that's supposed to protect our personal data, banking, info, and passwords.
Cybersecurity experts say this bug could affect more than 500,000 websites and allow hackers to steal our private data or impersonate us online.
So what is the Heartbleed bug and how can we protect ourselves against it? We've asked Nate Vack, a research programmer at the University of Wisconsin, to explain. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, the Heartbleed bug is all the talk this morning, especially in web security circles and among users. What is it?
So it is a bug by which hackers can download little pieces of data from web servers. They can't choose what data they're downloading, but they can just say, give me a little bit. And maybe that contains passwords or credit card numbers or things that let you log into websites, essentially.
And this is a vulnerability that some in the know have been aware of for a little while. It's just come out to the general public. What is the vulnerability within the software? What happens there?
So in the security communications protocol, there is something you can do called a heartbeat where you say, hey, just send some data back to me. I'm going to send you 1,000 bytes of data. Send me 1,000 bytes back. But really, you only send it 1 byte. And the server gets confused and just sends you 999 other bytes from somewhere that it knows about. It's a crapshoot what you get. So it's really weird.
So, hackers can't go in and say, I want to pull Veronica's credit card number. It's just sort of random what they get out of it.
Absolutely. So the data, one of the things that is really frustrating about this is this doesn't leave any traces in anybody's logs. It just looks like ordinary traffic to the rest of the world. So nobody can know how long people have been doing this. This bug, we've only known about it for a few weeks, but it's existed for 2 years. So there could have been evil people out there exploiting this for years and years, just downloading data, and we would never know. But again, nobody can go in and say, I want your data, Veronica, I want your data, Nate, and steal that.
So how widespread is the SSL encryption stuff that is being vulnerable right now to Heartbleed?
So SSL encryption backs everything that you do on the Internet that is secure. The good news is this isn't a design flaw. This is an implementation flaw. This is a bug in one specific kind of SSL software. The bad news is that it's a really popular one. It's one of the free ones that's used almost everywhere. So anything running on a modern Linux server, which, if you're a customer, you have no idea what is running on your website of choice. But it's not everything. And it's probably not even half or not even more than half.
A lot of times we'll be on a website, maybe doing some secure shopping, we think, and a little padlock will show up by the URL. And we assume that this means that what we're doing is safe, that it is private.
Yes.
So should we not be assuming that anymore?
Well, privacy is always relative, right? It's very private in general. It's not trivial by any means to just download all of this data, to break that privacy completely. One of the other risks that this bug has is there is a way for people to, by downloading all the memory on the server, find out how it's doing that encryption And then if that person can intercept your traffic, can also see what you're sending to and from that server, then it can read everything as it goes over the network, over a wireless network or such. That's really unlikely to happen on a widespread level and would be something that is very targeted in general, because intercepting a lot of traffic is very hard.
Can you give us a sense of some of the big sites that might be most affected by this?
I know that Yahoo was affected for a long time, or not a long time. I mean, nobody's been affected for a long time because it's been 24 hours. I believe Google and other, most people running any significant number of servers has something that is affected by this. And it's been interesting to see what services have sent me emails saying, hey, you should change your passwords. You should do X, Y, and Z. And that number has been a lot smaller than I expected, and I don't know quite what to make of that.
All right. Well, so speaking of changing your password and or freaking out, should we be doing both those things?
I wouldn't freak out about this. I would freak out if you're running a website. If you are running a website, you should not be listening to this radio show. You should be fixing your servers right now. But if you are, what I would do, honestly, is look at the emails that you've gotten from the services that you use. And if they say, hey, we think you should update your you should change your password, or we think something has been leaked, then take the actions they recommend.
And if you haven't gotten any emails, should you just stay the course and hope for the best?
I don't know exactly what else you can do. You could go and change your password everywhere, but that is kind of insane. One thing that's very important in general, and this kind of reinforces, is using the same password, using the same login and password on a whole lot of websites is a bad idea, because if one of these websites gives it up somehow, then people can get into all of your other websites. So if you've been thinking about, should I try one of those password manager things that lets me use a different password everywhere I go, now is a good time to do that.
And I understand that there are some programs now that will help you manage multiple passwords. I mean, the reason people use their pet's name for every login is that it's convenient and they can remember it. But
yeah.
You're saying get over that and maybe use one of these other tools for managing it.
One password is a really common one that people like a lot. Apple has some stuff built into its thing. I will admit that I'm not very good about this, and I use a throwaway password on a lot of websites. So now you know.
Now it's out there. Well, is this going to be a wake-up call for people that there are vulnerabilities? Maybe there always will be able to be waiting for the next shoe to drop. Maybe it's time, for instance, for tech companies to beef up their encryption software, too.
Even more than that, it is time to really think about how people architect stuff and to really think about, okay, does this server really need to know all of this information? Can we minimize the amount of data that we lose in the event of a breach, which is inconvenient because it's expensive to do that. It's easier to put everything on one box in general or not think about those things. But it is also risky as it lets little innocuous problems build on each other and get out of hand.
Nate, anything else we can do aside from changing our passwords to protect ourselves both from this Heartbleed bug and anything else that might be coming down the pike?
If you're really interested in checking if a website is vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug, you can just search for Heartbleed Tester on Google. And I'm not going to try and read web addresses over the phone because it's ridiculous. But you'll find some things that you just enter a web address and it will check and see, hey, is this site affected? And then just, always, I guess it's always worth thinking about what information you're giving to who when. Because even in a world where all of the technology works perfectly, when you're giving your data to a website, you have to trust that the people running that website are trustworthy, good people. And it's really easy to forget that, behind all those computers, there are people who you have to trust, too.
That's right. So it's not just the computers on their own. There are people behind, and people are vulnerable. So,
yeah.
Nate, thank you so much for joining us. You've given us some ideas, and I guess we'll just be waiting to see what happens next. We appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Nate Vack, a research programmer at the University of Wisconsin and co-founder and hacker-in-chief of an internet startup called Gimlet. And we posted the website to check if you've been affected on our Facebook page.
It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Yesterday, Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California introduced a bill that would require members of the House of Representatives to take sexual harassment training. It's something the Senate already does, not the House.
And on Monday, the Senate passed an extension of the long-term unemployment benefits that expired at the end of last year. Their revival has been contentious on Capitol Hill, sometimes seeming likely, other times not so much. And now it's up to the House to decide its fate.
And Democrats raised more money than Republicans last month in the Senate midterm election race. Paul Singer joins us now to talk about all these issues. He's with us every week at this time to look at the inner workings of Congress. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I'm busy changing my passwords at the moment.
But... Yeah. Hurry up and do that, or not. I'm still not quite sure. So as I mentioned, Congresswoman Speier proposed this requirement that everyone in the House would have to take sexual harassment training.
I think it's unnecessary. They seem to be perfectly well-trained in how to sexually harass people.
Ouch. Oh.
You know, this is all a fallout from this Congressman, Vance McAllister, who is a freshman from Louisiana, who was caught on a surveillance tape making out with one of his staffers, which is not bad unless, of course, in this case, the congressman happens to be married, as well as having run his campaign on a very sort of Christian conservative platform. So it's bad for him, and it just looks bad for the Congress. And they do this every couple of years. Somebody on Capitol Hill starts, you know, dating a staffer, cheating on their spouse, grabbing people they shouldn't be grabbing. And we go through this whole process of a conversation about, oh, we should have sexual harassment training. Like, no, you should be better human beings.
Well, the Senate has been doing this training, not the House. Do you know why the Senate got it, the House didn't?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Senate is smaller, and it's easier to do, you know, kind of one-on-one training with folks. The other thing is that even in the Senate, it's kind of ad hoc. I mean, both chambers have, you know, sort of training, particularly for new members. They get through a whole bunch of management training, how to set up an office. And keep in mind that each of these congressional offices operates like a separate business, a separate small business. It's particularly true in the House. So what trainings they get and how they implement them and what their sort of policies are, workplace policies are really dependent on each congressional office. There is no sort of overseer of the entire body.
This isn't a new issue, right? I mean, this is something that I would suspect has gone on for centuries and maybe is only now being viewed as a big problem?
I'm not even sure that's true. I mean, without slandering anybody improperly, I believe it was a Senator Bob Packwood who 25 years ago was, you know, forced out because of, you know, improper relations with women. There have been members of Congress for years who've been forced out or forced to step down. And keep in mind, in most of these cases, you're not talking about violations of law. What you're talking about is violations of sort of human rights and human interactions, and it's a public humiliation. People don't like being represented in Congress by folks who do this stuff.
This is a Democrat bringing this up after a scandal involving a Republican. Is the partisan issue there significant?
Not really. I mean, I think obviously the Democrats are going to make hay out of this one. You know, next week it'll be a Democrat. Don't worry about it.
And a lot of the reporting on this has mentioned the former congressman, Democratic congressman, and now former mayor of San Diego, who had massive sexual harassment problems of his own.
Right. And, you know, don't forget Anthony Weiner, one of our favorites, who was sending sexually inappropriate tweets to people. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do this wrong, and Congress frequently finds those ways.
So is this a law that would have to pass, or is this something that House leadership could just say, hey, this is the new rule?
Well, I mean, if it's a law that's going to pass, it's not going to happen. So then you can get to – I mean, the Congress can pass its own rules, but even that, keep in mind that when Congress passes new rules, they pass them as if they're laws. At the beginning of every session, they have to vote on them. So – you know, it really, again, it comes down to public humiliation. And I think, I mean, my suspicion is, and this is strictly suspicion, I have not reported on this much, that, like, this guy McAllister is probably going to get a lot of pressure now from Republican leaders to just go away. Again, it's not a formal rule. It's just they don't want this around.
Well, turning to legislation in Congress, we saw the Senate passing benefits for the long-term unemployed, back and forth on this for a long time now. Now it goes to the House. The president is saying, hey, House, pass this thing. What's going to happen there, do you think?
Well, they're pretty uninterested in passing it in the House for a couple of reasons. You know, one thing to keep in mind, now these benefits have been lapsed since December, and the short-term reinstatement would be a five-month reinstatement through basically the end of May. But, of course, we're getting up close to the end of May, so by the time they pass this bill, they're going to have to extend it again. And the House Republicans, their primary concern is that this is not paid for in any way. There's no offsets. There's no other provision in here to sort of create jobs. They're looking for, is there a way to do some sort of a tax credit or something else that would be a job creation portion or offsetting the cost of this benefit rather than simply being, you know, I think it's what, $10 billion worth of just direct aid. I don't see a great deal of enthusiasm for bringing this up in the House.
And that line of argument is pretty much the same as it was months ago, right? Democrats say this is an economic necessity. People are out of work. Republicans say, lovely, but we need to pay for it, and let's work in the job creation element.
Correct. Yeah, you will hear this over and over again. And again, even if the debate doesn't change, Democrats think this argument works in their favor because it makes them look like they are the ones who are helping the working man, and Republicans are opposing. So even if the House Republicans don't take it up, the Democrats will pass it again, just to make the point.
And is that a point then that they'll wave around in election ads and that sort of thing?
Sure is.
Do you think there's that much at stake for Republicans for not passing it, though? They can just say, hey, this is consistent with our views on spending and job creation.
Right, and I think they've made that bet at this point that stuff like this, it's a short-term aid package. It's not a long-term reform. It's not a major social program. This is the kind of thing where they feel like they can safely say, we are taking the conservative smart government stand against the sort of just give away a lot of money stand. And that's sort of the way they will position it. And I think they feel like they are on relatively solid ground there.
So there's a good shot that this will be one of the many things that the Senate and House disagree on, so nothing happens.
That is right. I know. I'm becoming repetitive on your show, but yeah, that's correct.
reality is being repetitive, I think.
Yes, you're just reporting it, man.
So speaking of those elections, we saw new reports on fundraising, mainly for the race for Senate, the midterm elections going on. Control of the Senate is at stake. Democrats control it right now. Republicans seem increasingly confident, as we've mentioned before, that they can take control. What did we see in the money race there?
Well, you know, all of these reports come out in the next week or so, the sort of quarterly reports for the big political campaigns. And I would warn you to look at all of them a little skeptically, because everyone's going to come out and say, ooh, we got the more money this quarter, and we got the less money last quarter, and we got more. And everyone finds a way to spin this. You know, one side will say, well, we got more money, but yeah, they've got more debt. Oh, yeah, we have more cash on hand. It's all very incremental.
So they're all waving around balance sheets at us.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, what the real issue for your listeners to keep in mind is that every year more and more and more money flows into this process, into the political process. And the committees, the party committees, are now sort of the shrinking portion of that money. Where the real money is going to start to show up is in these third-party groups, the 501c4, the super PACs, the political, non-political social welfare organizations. I mean, this is where you'll see enormous sums of money spent in particularly competitive races. And so when some of these various committees report, you know, a dollar amount for the quarter, sure, they'll put out a press release saying we did well, but that money is not going to matter much. What's really going to matter is the big outside money come, you know, September and October.
Well, the Supreme Court's Citizens United opinion a few years back opened the door to a lot of the money you were just talking about. How about this new one, the McCutcheon decision from the Supreme Court? Is that going to let more money flow back via the parties now?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one because the way it works now, you and I, of course, as journalists, don't actually give money to anybody. But if we wanted to, we'd be capped at $123,000 in total donations that we can give to candidates and party committees. What the Supreme Court ruled last week, I guess, is that those caps no longer stand. So now we can keep giving money. So in theory, I can walk into a room and write a check for $1 million. And then just that check gets divided up amongst as many candidates and party committees as will have it. Now, I'm still limited in how much money I can give to any one candidate or any one party committee for that election cycle. But now the caps on my total giving for the cycle are blown. I can salt my money around broadly.
And when it all comes down to it, do you think more money equals more votes?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, it's if you've got $1 billion and I get $1 billion, aren't we still battling over the same, 150 voters? Because again, Mitt Romney was right. 47% of the electorate is pretty much baked in for the Republicans. 47% is also baked in for the Democrats. Those are pretty much, locked in figures for a national race, and in a lot of the states, not far from that either. So there's just a few percentage points in the middle that we're both spending, $500 million to fight over. Are there more votes out there, or is it just we're applying more technology and techniques to squeeze out the last few?
We'll be watching that over the next few months. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time.